Joseph. But as we get into chapter 42, I want to start off by talking about three subjects. Three subjects, and the first one of those is forgiveness. Forgiveness. Jesus talked a lot about forgiveness. As a matter of fact, he gave a parable about a wicked servant, and he really wanted to bring home the point as he talks about this wicked servant who had embezzled or taken or borrowed or something a large amount of money. As a matter of fact, it was so much money that there is no way that he could ever pay it back. It was like the comparable to 1,500 years of wages. Jesus was just being overboard. And his master found out that he had taken this money. And so he called him in and he said, I want my money back. And he said, I can't do it. I've spent it all. And he said, all right, then I'm going to take you and your family and I'm going to put you all in prison for the rest of your life. And he begged and he pleaded and he said, please forgive me. And the master forgave him. Amazing thing. And then it says that that man went out, and as he was walking down the street, he ran across somebody who owed him like 20 bucks. And after he had just been forgiven so much, he said to the man, give me my 20 bucks, give me my money that's owed to me. And the man responded, I don't have it. Please forgive me. Same words. And the Bible says that he took the man and he threw him in jail. And Jesus said, when the master found out what happened, he came back to him and he said, listen, I am going to throw you and your family in jail because you were forgiven so much and you wouldn't forgive this other person. Jesus also, when he gave the model prayer, he put in there, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And at the end of that, in the Matthew's account, and I believe one other account, it tells us that he said, if you forgive, or God, that if God will forgive you your trespasses if you forgive others their trespasses. Peter came up to him one time and he said, how many times should we forgive somebody 7 times? And his answer wasn't 7. His answer was 70 times. 7 another time. He was confronted and he said, how many times should we forgive somebody? And they said, if a person sins against you 7 times in one day, you should forgive. And they ask for forgiveness, you should forgive them. These are all things Jesus said. Jesus was very big on forgiveness. And of course, that would make sense because that's what he came to do, right? To forgive us. To forgive us. As a matter of fact, there is a whole book of the Bible that is basically on the subject of forgiveness. Does anybody know what that is? I guess this will be our first question that maybe somebody can hear over the new thing here. Does anybody remember what book of the Bible is just basically all about forgiveness? The book of Philemon. It's all about forgiveness. It's all about forgiveness. Can I make a statement here? Without forgiveness, there is no Christianity. Without forgiveness, there is no purpose in having a church. Forgiveness is necessary. You all agree with me? I think God, scriptures would say forgiveness is really, really, really important. So there we go. We've talked about that. Let's talk about another one. Let's talk about a seared conscience. A seared conscience. Jiminy Cricket used to always say, let your conscience be your guide. After he said, give a little whistle, right? But he said, always let your conscience be your guide. And I believe that the Bible kind of says the same sort of things. Over this week, I have looked at every single verse in the Bible that talks about a conscience. Do you know it talks about all sorts of different consciences? It talks about a pure conscience, about a clear conscience, about a weak conscience, about a defiled conscience, about an evil conscience, about an untrained conscience. It's got all these verses that are talking about a conscience, and God gave us a conscience so that he can, so that it could help us to live the right way, so that when we are getting ready to sin and we know what is right, it'll lead us, right? God gave us a conscience. And the goal is that we would have a pure conscience. That's what Paul said to Timothy. A clear conscience. However, there are other ones there. There's the weak conscience. That is where we think that something is a sin when it's actually not. That comes about a lot of times by what's called an untrained conscience, where you have maybe grown up and you have had your conscience trained that something is wrong, but God never really said it was. I mean, the food that was offered to idols, are idols anything? No, Paul said they're not anything, but you know what? We've got weak brothers who've had untrained consciences who may think that it is. Then there's this other one that's called a seared conscience. And it's found only in one verse, 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 2. And well, let's go ahead and take a peek at that verse, 1 Timothy chapter 4. Verse 1 says this, but the Spirit explicitly says that in latter times some will fall away from the faith, paying attention to deceitful spirits and doctrines of demons by means of the hypocrisy of their hypocrisy of liars, seared in their own consciences as with a branding iron. One person said this about that. If the conscience is seared, it means that it's literally cauterized. It has been rendered insensitive. Such a conscience does not work properly. It's as if a spiritual scar tissue has dulled the senses of right and wrong, just as the hide of an animal scarred with a branding iron becomes numb to further pain. So the heart of an individual with a seared conscience is desensitized to moral pangs. So there we go. We've got this thing of having a seared conscience. A seared conscience. We talked this morning about delusions. You know, we've just kind of tricked ourselves. We've deceived our own hearts. This is beyond. This is when you know something is wrong, and it is wrong, and you say, "I'm not going to care. I'm going to put something there. I'm going to block it out so that it doesn't bother me that I'm doing it." A seared conscience. Here's a question you could ponder within yourself. If somebody has a seared conscience, can they ever change? We'll talk about that in a little bit. I bring up this idea of a seared conscience because one of the people that we're going to be talking about tonight had seared conscience. I brought up the idea of forgiveness because there's one person that we're going to talk about in Genesis 42 that needed to forgive. Third one is this, idols of the heart. Idols of the heart. One of the greatest sins that the children of Israel did was idolatry, all over. It was other gods that they placed before God himself. And in most cases, it was some sort of a statue or some sort of a symbol or something like that. As a matter of fact, if you go to Israel to visit there, the one way that you could distinguish an Old Testament city from a New Testament city is the Old Testament cities all had a place where you can know, where you can kind of see that there was an idol there. It was kind of in the town square. It was kind of in the middle of everything. Old Testament cities, they were constantly following after other gods. And they had Baal, who was there. And if you go to visit some of those places, that sometimes they've dug up some of the things there. And there is maybe a stone that is there. And basically, that is what Baal is. There's the Ashtaroth, which is the female version of Baal. And it would have been wood, so that didn't preserve, and you wouldn't see it, but there'd be a spot maybe there next to it that was there. And they constantly kept going back and worshiping all these different idols. However, in Ezekiel chapter 14, and if you would, go ahead and turn there. In Ezekiel chapter 14, we run across a different type of idol. An idol that wasn't made with hands, it wasn't made of silver, it wasn't made of stone, it wasn't made of any material wood like that. But it was an idol that was in their hearts. And it goes off, and it starts off in verse 1, then some of the elders of Israel came to me and sat down before me. And so here's Ezekiel, he said, and here I am, I'm a prophet of the Lord, and some of the elders of Israel came to me, and they wanted me to talk with God and get an answer from him. They wanted to get a response from God. And the word of the Lord came to me, saying, son of man, these men have set up their idols in their hearts and have put right before them their faces, the stumbling block of their iniquity. Should I be consulted? Should I be consulted by them at all? And God's response was, and we see this as you go on through the passage, that God is saying to them, listen, I'm not going to respond to them because they have idols in their hearts. It's not statues. It is ideology. It is things that they have that are more important to me. One person said this about idols of the heart. It is anything more important to you than God. Anything that absorbs your heart and imagination more than God. Anything you seek to give you what only God can give. An idol is whatever you look at and say in your heart of hearts, if I had that, then I feel my life has meaning and I know that I have value. Then I'll feel significant and secure. Now here's a question that I want you to kind of contemplate for a moment here. How bad is it to have an idol of the heart? The answer to that is, well, it is going against the very first commandment that God had. First commandment is, thou shalt have no other gods before me, right? Literally, in the Hebrew language, it'd say, you should have no other gods in my face, is what it's saying. You shouldn't have other ones where you basically say, God, I'd like to introduce you to this other thing that's really important to me. Shouldn't have any other gods before me. As a matter of fact, that's what he's saying here in Ezekiel chapter 14. These men have set up idols in their heart and have put right before their faces the stumbling block of iniquity. That's what they've done. They put this thing up there to block me from you. I bring this up because one of the people we're going to be talking about in this passage, Genesis 42, had an idol of the heart. So here we go. We're getting ready to go into Genesis chapter 42, and we know that there's one who needed to show forgiveness. We know that there was one who wanted to had a seared conscience, and one that had idols of the heart. Now, before we get into the one about forgiveness, let me throw out a little controversial thought here. All right, forgiveness seems like an easy thing, right? Forgive somebody. I went to a class in Ankeny, Iowa. And there I was. It was a week-long class that was going to have about four or five different speakers that were going to be there and kind of present things to us. And there was two main speakers that we went kind of from one room to the other room to the other room to the other room. That way they can catch their breath, but we needed to do all the work we could in a matter of a week to get some credits. And so there we go. And while we're going through that, one of the teachers was there and he started to talk about forgiveness. And he said, you know what? The Bible teaches us that we should forgive everybody about everything. And he basically went on, talked about forgiveness, and he brought in the verse that says that Jesus, when he was on the cross, he said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. They didn't ask for forgiveness, but he gave it to them anyways, right? I went to the next class, and the next class said, we're supposed to forgive just like God does. And he said, that is only when somebody asks for forgiveness. And so there we are sitting in class, and we're, you know, I was older. I wasn't one of the young bucks that were there, and I was sitting there listening. Yeah, I know that some people have differing opinions about different things. But he said, look at Scripture. And he said, look at this and think about this in salvation. Does God forgive everybody? He most certainly does not. He only forgives those who seek forgiveness. And then he brought in the passage that said, if your brother sins against you seven times in a day and asks you for forgiveness and says, please forgive me, then you forgive them each and every time. And he kind of brought in the idea too, really what good is forgiveness if it's not, what good is your forgiveness if God really isn't forgiving them? Interesting thought. We were sitting there. I went to one class, he's teaching one thing, the next one's teaching the other thing. So at the end of the week, we had a question and answer time. And there's a young guy that was there. And of course, we had all heard this, and several of us were older and several were younger. One of the younger ones raised his hand and they said, do you have any questions? He raised his hand and he said, we went to one class and they said that we're supposed to forgive everybody, and we went to another class right afterwards and they said that we're only supposed to forgive when we've been asked to forgive, and which is the right answer? And so the two of them were saying, oh, is that what you said? And an older guy who has taken the class, a guy who is quite a few years older than me, had been in ministry many more years than I had, and anybody else probably in the class. He said, can I help you with this one just for a moment? He said, what I've come to the conclusion with is that God tells us that we need to have a spirit of forgiveness. The idea that we're ready at any moment for anybody who ever does anything wrong to us, at any moment we're ready to forgive them. And we're not going to hold anything against them. We're not going to go around and say, you did this, you did this. We have this heart of forgiveness. But we really can't give forgiveness until, well, they want it. And because it's really not helping when we forgive and God doesn't. I thought that was a pretty wise answer that was given by him. I bring that up because when we run into the first person, there we go. In this passage, I think that's where it's going. Right? Genesis 42. Let's give a little bit of the background, verses 1 through 3. Let's read that. Now Jacob saw that there was grain in Egypt, and Jacob said to his sons, why are you staring at one another? He said, behold, I have heard that there's grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us from that place so that we may live and not die. Well, that's obviously, you know, here it is. The famine has spread beyond Egypt. It's gone to the areas that are around there. It's gone into Canaan land. And here they are. They are starving. And the brothers are all out there. They probably love to work and they would love to be out there trying to do different things to get some harvest for their sheep to be satisfied, all these different things. But there's nothing to do. And Dad says, hey, I heard that there's some grain in Egypt. Oh, it's really interesting how the story's starting to mix up a little bit. I hear that there's some grain in Egypt. Stop just staring at yourselves. Now get up and go out there and buy us some grain so that we can have some food and we can live. Well, verse 3, then 10 brothers of Joseph went down to buy grain from Egypt. Well, 10 plus Joseph, that's 11. Weren't there 12? Yeah, there's 12 sons, right? I wonder which one didn't go down there. Well, the answer is there in verse 4. But Joseph did not send, or Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers. Why? It says, because I'm afraid that harm may befall him. Yeah. It's been 13 plus 7. It's been at least 20 years, maybe 22 years, something like that, since he lost his son, Joseph, and he's still afraid. I think that'll come into contact when we start talking about Joseph's dad. So we come into verse 5, and here's where the story starts to get it. So the sons of Israel came to buy grain among those who were coming, for the famine in the land was great in the land of Canaan also. Now Joseph was the ruler over that land. He was the one who sold to all the people of the land, and Joseph's brother came and bowed down to him and their faces towards the ground. Now, I forgot to do this. Let's just take a moment and think back to what was going on right before this in chapter 42. We're talking about Joseph. Some things that happened was he was lifted up, he was exalted, he was made second in command. Here he was, and he ultimately had two sons. Do you remember what the two sons' names were? Anybody? Manasseh and Ephraim. Do you remember what their names meant? Yes, she's looking for her notes.
For God has made me forget all my toil and all my father's house. That's Manasseh.
Okay, so God made me forget was the first son, and the second one was?
He caused me to be fruitful.
So here's the business. He has finally, after all these years, he's forgotten, and he's looking forward, and he's seeing that God's blessing, and boy, this is great. And now, this event happens where his brothers show up, and it says in the passage two times, we haven't read it yet, but it says it two times, he recognized them. They came in. Some people look and they say, wow, this was a miraculous thing, because can you imagine all the people that were actually coming there that his brothers actually stood before him? It was kind of maybe a miracle, maybe not. Maybe, you know, gives an explanation here in the passage. But here they come. They come before him and they're there and they come and stand before them, but they weren't standing very long, right? Because they bowed down to him. Sound familiar? As a matter of fact, in verse 9, I think it is, it says, Joseph remembered the dream. And he saw them fulfilling that dream. His brothers were bowing down before him. Miraculous. But while he recognized them, they didn't recognize him. Maybe because he's 20 years older. Maybe because he's gone from a teenager to a man and an older man at that. Maybe because he's not speaking Hebrew. He's speaking Egyptian. There's going to be a translator there. They don't recognize him. Now, I want to ask you this question, and here we go here. How does Joseph need to respond? Here are his brothers, and there they are. They're bowing down before him. He needs to forgive them, doesn't he? They did a terrible thing to him. Terrible. Awful. He needs to forgive them. But what does he do? Interesting. Verse 6. No, verse 7. When Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them. First thing he does is he disguises himself. Do you remember any other time in the book of Genesis up to this point where somebody disguised themselves? I think it's happened like four times. Can you name some of them? Anybody? Genesis disguised themselves. Say it again. Abraham and Sarah. They disguised, he pretended like he was brother. All right? Anybody else? That's one of the four. Jacob. Jacob disguised himself. Oh, yeah. That's five. Yeah. He put the hair on his arm so that he pretended like he was his brother. There we go. Anybody else? Remember in Genesis chapter 3, Adam and Eve, they went and hid themselves, right? Abraham and Sarah did their one thing, and then his son, Isaac, and his wife Rebekah did the same thing. Let me ask you a question. In any of those cases, was it a wonderful thing that they disguised themselves? Not really. Well, that's the first thing he does. He disguises himself to them, and he spoke to them harshly. That's an interesting word. It's been used in Genesis when in Exodus, actually, when Moses, the guy who writes Genesis, stood before the people with the rock, remember? And he said to them, God said, you know, they were complaining about the water, and God said, I want you to go up to the rock, and this time instead of hitting it, I want you to speak to the rock. And he gets up there by the rock, and he's already with the rod, and he's about ready to speak to it. And then all of the people, he sees their faces, these complaining people who are just driving him nuts. And the Bible says he spoke harshly to them, and then he hit the rock twice. Did speaking harshly, was that a good thing for Moses to do? What turned out with that, right? He was told, you can't go into the promised land. Interesting. And he said to them, where have you come from? And they said, from the land of Canaan to buy food. And Joseph had recognized his brothers, although they didn't recognize him. Joseph remembered the dream about them, and he said to them, you are spies and have come to look at the undefended parts of our, I need to get to my notes, undefended parts of our land. He falsely accuses them. Now let's get out of Genesis. Let's think, is there anywhere in the Bible where people falsely accused somebody of something that they didn't do? Yeah. Jesus. Can I ask you, was that a good thing? The Ten Commandments, thou shalt falsely accuse people. Thou shalt speak harshly to them. You should disguise yourself and pretend like you're somebody else. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Not a good thing so far. And then he's going to put them in prison. Verse 10, then he said unto them, then they said to him, no, my Lord, but your servants have come to buy food. We are all sons of one man. He's accused them of being spies. He said, listen, we've all come to buy food. I know there's 10 of us, probably because each one would get a certain amount of grain that they could take back. That's why they sent so many of them. And then he said, we are all sons of one man. We are honest men. Your servants are not spies. They're telling them the truth. They're just kind of saying, here's how it is. Yet he said to them, no, you've not come to look at the undefended parts of our land. But he said, your servants are 12, but they said, your servants are 12 brothers and all the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And behold, the younger is with our father today, and one is no longer alive. Interesting. I wonder if they thought he was dead by now. Or, well, as we'll talk about them later. And Joseph said to them, it is, as I said, you are spies, and by this you will be tested by the life of Pharaoh. You shall not go from this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you that you may get your brother while you remain confined in your, that your words may be tested whether there is truth in you. But if not by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are all spies. So he put them all in prison for 3 days. Joseph knows about being in prison, right? I wonder if we're sitting here thinking, I wonder if he's just trying to give them a little taste of what he went through. He goes through this whole charade. He said, I want you to go get your brother just to prove it, even though he already knew it. And he said, I want you to go get him. I'm going to have all of you in jail. One of you can go and get him later. He's going to change the thing after 3 days. Verse 18, now Joseph said to them on the third day, do this and live, for I fear God. He's getting a little merciful here. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers be confined in your prison. But as for the rest of you, go carry grain for your families of your household and bring your youngest brother to me so your words may be verified and you will not die. So he says, all right, instead of 9 of you staying here and 1 going away, I'm going to have 1 of you stay here and I'm going to send the other 9, go get your brother, bring him back, and then I'll know you're not spies. Interesting. Interesting. The question comes now, was he vengeful or what? He's disguising himself. He's accusing them. He's putting them in jail. He's speaking harshly. Is he being vengeful or what? As I looked at that and I studied it, I come down to this conclusion in my heart. I don't think so. I don't think he's being vengeful. I say that for a few reasons. Because, first of all, what it said about his kids, that he had forgotten, that he had gone to this place where now things are better and he's looking forward. I say it because when his brothers start talking back to him and they think that he can't hear it because he's got a translator there, but he knows their language. Bible says he goes off and cries because of him giving the money back to them, which we're going to see here in a little bit, because of his ultimate reveal that's going to happen at the end of all of this, and how he's had this heart of trusting God throughout, and the ultimate result of what has gone on, I think he's caught on as to what God's doing as he's putting all these pieces together. I don't think that he was being vengeful. I think God was using him to put his brothers in the proper place to where they could really be forgiven. Because God is going to start working in their hearts so that they're going to turn from these guys that were, well, we'll talk about that in a moment. Well, that brings us to the next group of people. That's Joseph's brothers. We pick it up in verse 21. Well, at the end of verse 20, and they did it. They did so. They said, all right, 9 of them headed off, and they said to one another, oops, truly we are guilty concerning our brother because we saw the distress of his soul when he pleaded with us yet we would not listen. Therefore, this distress has come upon us. Reuben answered them, saying, did I not tell you, do not sin against the boy, and you would not listen? Now comes the reckoning for his blood. I said before that these guys must have had a seared heart. Let me back that up. I need to look back. I keep forgetting to do that. What do we know about these guys? The Bible has told us up to this point some things about these sons, these 12 sons of Jacob, sons of Israel. Oh, and let me see if I could find my list that I have. All right, the oldest one. Does anybody remember who the oldest one was? The oldest one was Reuben. The one thing the Bible tells us about Reuben is that he had an affair with his dad's concubine who ultimately turned into his wife. We read that? Good guy, huh? Good guy. Then we have Simon and Levi are the next two oldest ones, Simon and Levi. The Bible does tell us something about Simon and Levi, and it tells us this, that they were the ones who, when Dinah, their sister, was taken by this guy in Shechem, this leading guy in there, and had relations with her, that they were the two who went there and killed every man in town. You remember that story, how that went? Yeah, that was kind of a gross story. We won't talk about it here in church right now. Good guys, right? Good guys. Then there was Judah. He was the fourth one. He was the one who said, let's sell them. And then there's something else. We skipped over. We did chapter 37. Then we did 39, 40, 41. Now we're in 42. We forgot 38. That was a whole story about this guy named Judah. After they sold him and he said, let's sell him, he must have got some money because in chapter 38 starts off, it says, then he went off on his own. And he went over to this place and he married a woman who was not part of the family, and you know that he wasn't following the way that God had things set up, and he marries this woman. They have three sons. I'm not going to tell you their names because I don't remember all their names. They had three sons. First one married this woman by the name of Tamar, and then that oldest son died. And in the tradition of that time, what you would do is if an older brother died and the woman he was married to, if the next son wasn't married, so he married her. The idea was so that she could have a child so that they can have the family name go on. But that son refused, although he married, he refused to have relations with her in a way that where she could be pregnant. And then God wasn't happy with that. And he died. Third one, Judah, says, all right, I promise you that you can marry the third one, but he's not old enough yet. So give it some time. Let him grow up. Let him get old enough. And then you two can get married. Well, he grew up and dad changed his mind. And so here's Tamar, this woman. She's all by herself. What is she to do? Nobody else will marry her because, well, she's already been married a couple of times and it's all to this family and that's the way it's supposed to work. And, yeah, Judas says, forget it. And so Judah goes off to a sheep shearing party. Back in those days, I guess that was the way that you had fun. You go there and you get all the wool off the sheep, and all the guys are going to be rich then, and so they drink and do all those things. And, well, Tamar knew her father-in-law, Judah, and he knew that while he was away, the mouse will play. Something like that, right? She knew that he was going to be unfaithful. And so she went to town and pretended like she was a prostitute, put a veil over her face, and he came walking by and he said, sure. And she got pregnant. And he said, how much money should I give you for this? And she said, don't give me money. Give me some symbols of things that you have. And so he gave her the cord off of his belt. He gave her his staff and something else. Signet ring, maybe? I don't remember. And so off he goes, had a good time at the sheep shearing party. 3 months later, she shows up and she's pregnant. And what is Judah going to say to that? Shame on you, you wicked, nasty woman. He's going to have her burned at the stake or something like that. And she says, wait a second, as they're dragging her off, I want to give you something. Here's your staff and here's your cord and here's this other thing. And you could hear his jaw drop. Let her go. So we've got the oldest son who has an affair with dad's wife. We have Simeon and Levi who killed all the people in Shechem. And here's this Judah guy. Wow, these are great guys, right? Just wonderful men. Now, there's four more that are mentioned. Gad, Asher, Dan, and Naphtali. The only thing that we know about them that is mentioned about them is that they were lazy at their job. That's why Joseph told on them. Then there's Joseph and Benjamin. That's 10 that are told things about them. There's two more, Issachar and Zebulun. Nothing is specifically said about them, but they were part of everyone who said, let's kill them. Let's throw them in the pit. Let's sell them. Great group of guys, right? And then the epitome of all that, they have put him in the pit, and we're gonna kill him. They sell him off, and now it's 22 years later. Has anybody had such a heart and a conscience to where they said, "Dad, we did wrong"? In 22 years, Dad, we sinned. He's not dead. We sold him. No. I think it's fair to say that they, in that issue, and maybe in much of their life, when it comes to God, they had a seared conscience. You agree with me, Singh? Maybe? I asked you the question earlier. Can God change a seared heart? Here we go. In verses 21 and 22, they're just talking amongst themselves. And they said, we've been put in jail. They think that we're spies. I think we're getting what we deserve. We should have never, ever done what we did to our brother. And Reuben, who maybe didn't even know that they sold him. Some people would say that as they study it, because it doesn't exactly say that they did. He says to them, I told you, don't kill him. God's starting to work. Verse 23, they did not know, however, that Joseph understood, for there was an interpreter between them, and he turned away from them and wept. But he's still going to continue on with things, because I think that he's going to be used by God to grab their hearts. But when they returned to them and he spoke to them, he took Simon from them and bound them before their eyes. And Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain and to restore every man's money in his sack and to give them provisions for the journey. And thus it was done for them. So Joseph says, all right, on their way back, give them the grain they need, give them their money back. I'm not sure if he had plans with this, but God did. So they loaded their donkeys with the grain and they departed from there. And as one of them opened his sack to give his donkey fodder at the lodging place, he saw his money, and behold, it was at the mouth of his sack. And what does he say? My money has been returned, and behold, it is even in my sack. And their hearts sank, and they turned trembling. You see, they're shaking. Grown men shaking, saying, what is this that God has done to us? Can a seared heart be changed by God? Oh, he's starting. He's starting. They begin to open. Oh, we got 4 minutes. Let's see if we can get Dad into this. Looking back, we remember that Jacob had two major problems. Problem number one was when things were going bad with the kids, he was hands off and didn't do anything. We talked about that before. The other thing was he played favorites, right? Two major problems. So, let's see what I put in notes. All right. So verse 29, and when they came to their father Jacob in the land of Canaan, they told him all that had happened to him, saying, the man, the Lord of the land, spoke harshly with us and took us for spies of the country. But we said unto him, we are honest men. We are not spies. We are 12 brothers, sons of one father. One is no longer alive, and the youngest is with our father today in the land of Canaan. And the man, the Lord of the land, said unto us, by this I know that you are honest men. Leave one of your brothers with me and take grain for the famine in your households and go, but bring your youngest brother to me that I may know that you are not spies, but honest men. I will give your brother to you, and you may trade in the land. Now it came about as they were emptying their sacks that, behold, every man's bundle of money was in the sack. And when they and their father saw the bundles of money, they were dismayed. So they come back and they say, Dad, here's the thing that's going on. They tell him exactly what has happened. They're honest. They're truthful. They say it exactly pretty much the way it was, just kind of putting a good side to it, just talking about the way that they're going to trust him if they bring back Benjamin with them. And so Simeon is over there in Egypt. He's got a son that's over there, and he needs to protect that son, right? This is his second son, the second oldest son, second born. By the way, Jacob already knew that what his oldest son had done with his daughter, or with his concubine, his wife, he was going to later on kind of write him off. You're not going to get the double blessing. Simeon would have been the next one in line. And here he is there. He's out there. The second son, the one that's kind of maybe going to inherit everything. And how is he going to respond? Not only that, Dad, if we bring Benjamin back, we're going to be able to bring Simeon back and we can get more grain so that we can all survive. But what does Dad do? Their father, Jacob, said to them, you have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more and Simeon is no more. And you want to take Benjamin? All these things are against me. He says, no. You're not taking Benjamin. Reuben's trying to bring some sense, and Reuben, the oldest son, spoke to his father saying, you may put my two sons to death if I don't bring him back to you. Put him in my care, and I will return him to you. Reuben didn't have to say this, but he's going to come and he's going to say, Dad, I will let my sons die if I don't bring back Benjamin to you. But Jacob said, my son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead and he alone is left. If harm should befall him on the journey you are taking, then you will bring my gray hair down to Sheol in sorrow. Jacob had something that was more important to him than all the rest of his family, more important to him than God. He had an idol of a heart. It wasn't a statue. It was his wife, Rachel, who had an older son by the name of Joseph that was an idol of his heart that he cared about more than all of his other brothers, cared about more than God. Who, when he was gone, he only had Benjamin, and he cared more about him than he cared about all of the rest of the family. They all could die of starvation. Simeon, my second oldest son, can die, but he's more important to me. Well, with that, we have to stop. We'll have to pick it up next week. It's 7:01. If you have any questions, ask Dan. He'll give you the answer to them. All right. Dan, do you mind closing in a word of prayer for us?
Father, we just thank you for this time that we're able to come together and hear your word. We just thank you for this messenger. We just ask that you apply it to our lives in the upcoming days. In your son's name, amen.